The other piece of advice I want to give you before moving on to the next level of the toolbox is this. The adverb is not your friend. Adverbs, you will remember from your own version of business English, are words that modify verbs, adjectives, and other adverbs. They're the ones that usually end in ly. Adverbs, like the passive voice, seem to have been created with the timid writer in mind. With the passive voice, the writer usually expresses fear of not being taken seriously. It is the voice of little boys wearing shoe-polish mustaches and little girls clumping around in mommy's high heels. With adverbs, the writer usually tells us he or she is afraid he/she isn't expressing himself/herself clearly, that he or she is not getting the point or the picture across. Consider the sentence, "He closed the door firmly." It's by no means a terrible sentence, at least it's got an active verb going for it, but ask yourself if firmly really has to be there. You can argue that it expresses a degree of difference between he closed the door and he slammed the door, and you'll get no argument from me. But what about context? What about all the enlightening, not to say emotionally moving, prose which came before he closed the door firmly? Shouldn't this tell us how he closed the door? And if the foregoing prose does tell us, isn't firmly an extra word? Isn't it redundant? Someone out there is now accusing me of being tiresome and anal retentive. I deny it. I believe the road to hell is paved with adverbs, and I will shout it from the rooftops. To put it another way, they're like dandelions. If you have one on your lawn, it looks pretty and unique. If you fail to root it out, however, you find 5 the next day, 50 the day after that, and then, my brothers and sisters, your lawn is totally, completely, and profligately covered with dandelions. By then, you see them for the weeds they really are, but by then it's too late. I can be a good sport about adverbs, though. Yes, I can. With one exception, dialogue attribution. I insist that you use the adverb in dialogue attribution only in the rarest and most special of occasions, and not even then if you can avoid it. Just to make sure we all know what we're talking about, examine these 3 sentences. "Put it down," she shouted. "Give it back," he pleaded. "It's mine." "Don't be such a fool, Jekyll," Utterson said. In these sentences, shouted, pleaded, and said are verbs of dialogue attribution. Now, consider these dubious revisions. "Put it down," she shouted menacingly. "Give it back," he pleaded abjectly. "It's mine." "Don't be such a fool, Jekyll," Utterson said contemptuously. The 3 latter sentences are all weaker than the 3 former ones, and most readers will see why immediately. "Don't be such a fool, Jekyll," Utterson said contemptuously, is the best of the lot. It is only a cliché, while the other 2 are actively ludicrous. Such dialogue attributions are sometimes known as Swifties, after Tom Swift, the brave inventor hero in a series of boys' adventure novels written by Victor Appleton II. Appleton was fond of such sentences as, "Do your worst," Tom cried bravely, and "My father helped with the equations," Tom said modestly. When I was a teenager, there was a party game based on one's ability to create witty or half-witty Swifties. "You've got a nice butt, lady," he said cheekily, is one I remember. Another is, "I'm the plumber," he said with a flush. In this case, the modifier is an adverbial phrase. When debating whether or not to make some pernicious dandelion of an adverb part of your dialogue attribution, I suggest you ask yourself if you really want to write the sort of prose that might wind up in a party game. Some writers try to evade the no adverb rule by shooting the attribution verb full of steroids. The result is familiar to any reader of pulp fiction or paperback originals. "Put down the gun, Utterson," Jekyll grated. "Never stop kissing me," Shayna gasped. "You damn tease," Bill jerked out. Don't do these things. Please, oh please. The best form of dialogue attribution is said, as in he said, she said, Bill said, Monica said. If you want to see this put stringently into practice, I urge you to read or reread a novel by Larry McMurtry, The Shane of Dialogue Attribution. That looks damn snide on the page, but I'm speaking with complete sincerity. McMurtry has allowed few adverbial dandelions to grow on his lawn. He believes in he said, she said, even in moments of emotional crisis. And in Larry McMurtry novels, there are a lot of those. Go and do thou likewise. Is this a case of do as I say, not as I do? The reader has a perfect right to ask the question, and I have a duty to provide an honest answer. Yes, it is. You need only look back through some of my own fiction to know that I'm just another ordinary sinner. I've been pretty good about avoiding the passive tense, but I've spilled out my share of adverbs in my time, including some, it shames me to say it, in dialogue attribution. I have never fallen so low as he grated or Bill jerked out, though. When I do it, it's usually for the same reason any writer does it, because I am afraid the reader won't understand me if I don't. I'm convinced that fear is at the root of most bad writing. If one is writing for one's own pleasure, that fear may be mild. Timidity is the word I've used here. If, however, one is working under deadline, a school paper, a newspaper article, the SAT writing sample, that fear may be intense. Dumbo got airborne with the help of a magic feather. You may feel the urge to grasp a passive verb or one of those nasty adverbs for the same reason. Just remember before you do that Dumbo didn't need the feather. The magic was in him. You probably do know what you're talking about and can safely energize your prose with active verbs. And you probably have told your story well enough to believe that when you use he said, the reader will know how he said it, fast or slowly, happily or sadly. Your man may be floundering in a swamp, and by all means throw him a rope if he is, but there's no need to knock him unconscious with 90 feet of steel cable. Good writing is often about letting go of fear and affectation. Affectation itself, beginning with the need to define some sorts of writing as good and other sorts as bad, is fearful behavior. Good writing is also about making good choices when it comes to picking the tools you plan to work with. No writer is entirely without sin in these matters. Although William Strunk got E.B. White in his clutches when White was but a naive undergraduate at Cornell, give them to me when they're young and they're mine forever. And although White both understood and shared Strunk's prejudice against loose writing and the loose thinking which prompts it, he admits, I suppose I have written the fact that 1,000 times in the heat of composition, revised it out maybe 500 times in the cool aftermath. To be batting only 500 this late in the season, to fail half the time to connect with this fat pitch, saddens me. Yet E.B. White went on to write for a good many years following his initial revisions of Strunk's little book in 1957. I will go on writing in spite of such stupid lapses as, "You can't be serious," Bill said unbelievingly. I expect you to do the same thing. There is a core simplicity to the English language and its American variant, but it's a slippery core. All I ask is that you do as well as you can, and remember that, while to write adverbs is human, to write he said or she said is divine. Lift out the top layer of your toolbox, your vocabulary and all the grammar stuff. On the layer beneath go those elements of style upon which I've already touched. Strunk and White offer the best tools and the best rules you could hope for, describing them simply and clearly. They are offered with a refreshing strictness, beginning with the rule on how to form possessives. You always add apostrophe S, even when the word you're modifying ends in S. Always write Thomas's bike and never Thomas' bike. And ending with ideas about where it's best to place the most important parts of a sentence. They say at the end, and everyone's entitled to his or her opinion, but I don't believe with a hammer he killed Frank will ever replace he killed Frank with a hammer. Before leaving the basic elements of form and style, we ought to think for a moment about the paragraph, the form of organization which comes after the sentence. To that end, grab a novel, preferably one you haven't yet read, down from your shelf. The stuff I'm telling you applies to most prose, but since I'm a fiction writer, it's fiction I usually think about when I think about writing. Open the book in the middle and look at any two pages. Observe the pattern, the lines of type, the margins, and most particularly the blocks of white space where paragraphs begin or leave off. You can tell without even reading if the book you've chosen is apt to be easy or hard, right? Easy books contain lots of short paragraphs, including dialogue paragraphs which may only be a word or two long, and lots of white space. They're as airy as Dairy Queen ice cream cones. Hard books, ones full of ideas, narration, or description, have a stouter look, a packed look. Paragraphs are almost as important for how they look as for what they say. They are maps of intent. In expository prose, paragraphs can and should be neat and utilitarian. The ideal expository graph contains a topic sentence followed by others which explain or amplify the first. Here are two paragraphs from the ever-popular informal essay which illustrate this simple but powerful form of writing. Paragraph 1. When I was 10, I feared my sister Megan. It was impossible for her to come into my room without breaking at least one of my favorite toys, usually the favorite of favorites. Her gaze had some magical tape-destroying quality. Any poster she looked at seemed to fall off the wall only seconds later. Well-loved articles of clothing disappeared from the closet. She didn't take them, at least I don't think so, only made them vanish. I'd usually find that treasured T-shirt or my favorite Nikes deep under the bed months later, looking sad and abandoned among the dust kitties. When Megan was in my room, stereo speakers blew, window shades flew up with a bang, and the lamp on my desk usually went dead. And the second paragraph. She could be consciously cruel, too. On one occasion, Megan poured orange juice into my cereal. On another, she squirted toothpaste into the toes of my socks while I was taking a shower. And although she never admitted it, I am positive that whenever I fell asleep on the couch during halftime of the Sunday afternoon pro football games on TV, she rubbed boogers in my hair. Informal essays are, by and large, silly and insubstantial things. Unless you get a job as a columnist at your local newspaper, writing such fluffery is a skill you'll never use in the actual mall and filling station world. Teachers assign them when they can't think of any other way to waste your time. The most notorious subject, of course, is how I spent my summer vacation. I taught writing for a year at the University of Maine in Orono and had one class loaded with athletes and cheerleaders. They liked informal essays, greeting them like the old high school friends they were. I spent one whole semester fighting the urge to ask them to write two pages of well-turned prose on the subject of If Jesus Were My Teammate. What held me back was the sure and terrible knowledge that most of them would take to the task with enthusiasm. Some might actually weep while in the throes of composition. Even in the informal essay, however, it's possible to see how strong the basic paragraph form can be. Topic sentence followed by support and description insists that the writer organize his or her thoughts, and it also provides good insurance against wandering away from the topic. Wandering isn't a big deal in an informal essay. It's practically de rigueur, as a matter of fact. But it's a very bad habit to get into when working on more serious subjects in a more formal manner. Writing is refined thinking. If your master's thesis is no more organized than a high school essay titled Why Shania Twain Turns Me On, you're in big trouble. In fiction, the paragraph is less structured. It's the beat instead of the actual melody. The more fiction you read and write, the more you'll find your paragraphs forming on their own. And that's what you want. When composing, it's best not to think too much about where paragraphs begin and end. The trick is to let nature take its course. If you don't like it later on, fix it then. That's what rewrite is all about. Now, check out the following. Big Tony's room wasn't what Dale had expected. The light had an odd yellowish cast that reminded him of cheap motels he'd stayed in, the ones where he always seemed to end up with a scenic view of the parking lot. The only picture was Miss May hanging askew on a pushpin, one shiny black shoe stuck out from under the bed.
"I don't know why you keep on asking me about O'Leary," Big Tony said. "You think my story's gonna change?"
"Is it?" Dale asked.
"When your story's true, it don't change. The truth is always the same boring shit, day in and day out."
Big Tony sat down, lit a cigarette, ran a hand through his hair.
"I ain't seen that fucking Mick since last summer. I let him hang around because he made me laugh. Once showed me this thing he wrote about what it would have been like if Jesus was on his high school football team. Had a picture of Christ in a helmet and knee pads and everything, but what a troublesome little fuck he turned out to be. I wish I'd never seen him."
We could have a 50-minute writing class on just this brief passage. It would encompass dialogue attribution, not necessary if we know who's speaking. Rule 17, omit needless words in action. Phonetically rendered language, dunno, gonna, the use of the comma. There is none in the line,
"When your story's true, it don't change."
Because I want you to hear it coming out all in one breath, without a pause. The decision not to use the apostrophe when the speaker has dropped a G. And all that stuff is just from the top level of the toolbox. Let's stick with the paragraphs, though. Notice how easily they flow with the turns and rhythms of the story dictating where each one begins and ends. The opening graph is of the classic type, beginning with a topic sentence that is supported by the sentences which follow. Others, however, exist solely to differentiate between Dale's dialogue and Big Tony's. The most interesting paragraph is the fifth one. Big Tony sat down, lit a cigarette, ran a hand through his hair. It's only a single sentence long, and expository paragraphs almost never consist of a single sentence. It's not even a very good sentence, technically speaking. To make it perfect in the Warrener sense, there should be a conjunction, and. Big Tony sat down, lit a cigarette, and ran a hand through his hair. Also, what exactly is the purpose of this paragraph? First, the sentence may be flawed in a technical sense, but it's a good one in terms of the entire passage. Its brevity and telegraphic style vary the pace and keep the writing fresh. Suspense novelist Jonathan Kellerman uses this technique very successfully. In Survival of the Fittest, he writes, "The boat was 30 feet of sleek white fiberglass with gray trim. Tall masts, the sails tied. Satori painted on the hull in black script, edged with gold." It's possible to overuse the well-turned fragment, and Kellerman sometimes does, but frags can also work beautifully to streamline narration, create clear images, and create tension, as well as to vary the prose line. A series of grammatically proper sentences can stiffen that line, make it less pliable. Purists hate to hear that and will deny it to their dying breath, but it's true. Language does not always have to wear a tie and lace up shoes. The object of fiction isn't grammatical correctness, but to make the reader welcome and then tell a story, to make him or her forget, whenever possible, that he or she is reading a story at all. The single-sentence paragraph more closely resembles talk than writing, and that's good. Writing is seduction. Good talk is a part of seduction. If not so, why do so many couples who start the evening at dinner wind up in bed? The other uses of this paragraph include stage direction, minor but useful enhancement of character and setting, and a vital moment of transition. From protesting that his story is true, Big Tony moves on to his memories of O'Leary. Since the source of dialogue doesn't change, Tony sitting down and lighting up could take place in the same paragraph, with the dialogue picking up again afterward, but the writer doesn't elect to do it this way. Because Tony takes a new tack, the writer breaks the dialogue into two paragraphs. It's a decision made instantaneously in the course of writing, one based entirely on the beat the writer hears in his or her own head. That beat is part of the genetic hardwiring. Kellerman writes a lot of frags because he hears a lot of frags. But it's also the result of the thousands of hours that writer has spent composing and the tens of thousands of hours he or she may have spent reading the compositions of others. I would argue that the paragraph, not the sentence, is the basic unit of writing, the place where coherence begins and words stand a chance of becoming more than mere words. If the moment of quickening is to come, it comes at the level of the paragraph. It is a marvelous and flexible instrument that can be a single word long or run on for pages. One paragraph in Don Robertson's historical novel, Paradise Falls, is 16 pages long. There are paragraphs in Ross Lockridge's Raintree County, which are nearly that. You must learn to use it well if you are to write well. What this means is lots of practice. You have to learn the beat. Grab that book you were looking at off the shelf again, would you? The weight of it in your hands tells you other stuff that you can take in without reading a single word. The book's length, naturally, but more. The commitment the writer shouldered in order to create the work. The commitment constant reader must make to digest it. Not that length and weight alone indicate excellence. Many epic tales are pretty much epic crap. Just ask my critics, who will moan about entire Canadian forests massacred in order to print my drivel. Conversely, short doesn't always mean sweet. In some cases, the bridges of Madison County, for instance, short means far too sweet. But there is that matter of commitment, whether a book is good or bad, a failure or a success. Words have weight. Ask anyone who works in the shipping department of a book company warehouse or in the storage room of a large bookstore. Words create sentences. Sentences create paragraphs. Sometimes paragraphs quicken and begin to breathe. Imagine, if you like, Frankenstein's monster on its slab. Here comes lightning, not from the sky, but from a humble paragraph of English words. Maybe it's the first really good paragraph you ever wrote, something so fragile and yet full of possibility that you were frightened. You feel as Victor Frankenstein must have when the dead conglomeration of sewn-together spare parts suddenly opened its watery yellow eyes. Oh, my God, it's breathing, you realize. Maybe it's even thinking, what in hell's name do I do next? You go on to the third level, of course, and begin to write real fiction. Why shouldn't you? Why should you fear? Carpenters don't build monsters, after all. They build houses, stores, and banks. They build some of wood a plank at a time, and some of brick a brick at a time. You will build a paragraph at a time, constructing these of your vocabulary and your knowledge of grammar and basic style. As long as you stay level on the level and shave even every door, you can build whatever you like. Whole mansions, if you have the energy. Is there any rationale for building entire mansions of words? I think there is, and that the readers of Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind and Charles Dickens's Bleak House understand it. Sometimes even a monster is no monster. Sometimes it's beautiful, and we fall in love with all that story more than any film or TV program could ever hope to provide. Even after 1,000 pages, we don't want to leave the world the writer has made for us or the make-believe people who live there. You wouldn't leave after 2,000 pages if there were 2,000. The Rings trilogy of J.R.R. Tolkien is a perfect example of this. 1,000 pages of Hobbits hasn't been enough for 3 generations of post-World War II fantasy fans. Even when you add in that clumsy, galumphing dirigible of an epilogue, The Silmarillion, it hasn't been enough. Hence, Terry Brooks, Piers Anthony, Robert Jordan, the questing rabbits of Watership Down, and 50 others. The writers of these books are creating the hobbits they still love and pine for. They are trying to bring Frodo and Sam back from the Grey Havens because Tolkien is no longer around to do it for them. At its most basic, we are only discussing a learned skill, but do we not agree that sometimes the most basic skills can create things far beyond our expectations? We are talking about tools and carpentry, about words and style, but as we move along, you do well to remember that we are also talking about magic. On Writing. There are no bad dogs, according to the title of a popular training manual, but don't tell that to the parent of a child mauled by a pit bull or a Rottweiler. He or she is apt to bust your beak for you. And no matter how much I want to encourage the man or woman trying for the first time to write seriously, I can't lie and say there are no bad writers. Sorry, but there are lots of bad writers. Some are on staff at your local newspaper, usually reviewing little theater productions or pontificating about the local sports teams. Some have scribbled their way to homes in the Caribbean, leaving a trail of pulsing adverbs, wooden characters, and vile passive voice constructions behind them. Others hold forth at open mic poetry slams, wearing black turtlenecks and wrinkled khaki pants. They spout doggerel about my angry lesbian breasts and the tilted alley where I cried my mother's name. Writers form themselves into the pyramid we see in all areas of human talent and human creativity. At the bottom are the bad ones. Above them is a group which is slightly smaller but still large and welcoming. These are the competent writers. They may also be found on the staff of your local newspaper, on the racks at your local bookstore, and at poetry readings on open mic night. These are folks who somehow understand that although a lesbian may be angry, her breasts will remain breasts. The next level is much smaller. These are the really good writers. Above them, above almost all of us, are the Shakespeares, the Faulkners, the Yeatses, Shaws, and Eudora Welties. They are geniuses, divine accidents, gifted in a way which is beyond our ability to understand, let alone attain. Shit, most geniuses aren't able to understand themselves, and many of them lead miserable lives, realizing, at least on some level, that they are nothing but fortunate freaks, the intellectual version of runway models who just happen to be born with the right cheekbones and with breasts which fit the image of an age. I am approaching the heart of this book with two theses, both simple. The first is that good writing consists of mastering the fundamentals, vocabulary, grammar, the elements of style, and then filling the third level of your toolbox with the right instruments. The second is that while it is impossible to make a competent writer out of a bad writer, and while it is equally impossible to make a great writer out of a good one, it is possible, with lots of hard work, dedication, and timely help, to make a good writer out of a merely competent one. I'm afraid this idea is rejected by lots of critics and plenty of writing teachers as well. Many of these are liberals in their politics, but crustaceans in their chosen fields. Men and women who would take to the streets to protest the exclusion of African Americans or Native Americans, I can imagine what Mr. Strunk would have made of these politically correct but clunky terms, from the local country club are often the same men and women who tell their classes that writing ability is fixed and immutable. Once a hack, always a hack. Even if a writer rises in the estimation of an influential critic or two, he or she always carries his or her early reputation along, like a respectable married woman who was a wild child as a teenager. Some people never forget, that's all, and a good deal of literary criticism serves only to reinforce a caste system which is as old as the intellectual snobbery which nurtured it. Raymond Chandler may be recognized now as an important figure in 20th century American literature, an early voice describing the anomie of urban life in the years after World War II. But there are plenty of critics who will reject such a judgment out of hand. "He's a hack," they cry indignantly. "A hack with pretensions, the worst kind, the kind who thinks he can pass for one of us." Critics who try to rise above this intellectual hardening of the arteries usually meet with limited success. Their colleagues may accept Chandler into the company of the great, but are apt to seat him at the foot of the table. And there are always those whispers, "Came out of the pulp tradition, you know. Carries himself well for one of those, doesn't he? Did you know he wrote for Black Mask in the 30s? Yes, regrettable." Even Charles Dickens, the Shakespeare of the novel, has faced a constant critical attack as a result of his often sensational subject matter, his cheerful fecundity, when he wasn't creating novels, he and his wife were creating children. And, of course, his success with the book-reading groundlings of his time and ours. Critics and scholars have always been suspicious of popular success. Often their suspicions are justified. In other cases, these suspicions are used as an excuse not to think. No one can be as intellectually slothful as a really smart person. Give smart people half a chance and they will ship their oars and drift, dozing to Byzantium, you might say. So yes, I expect to be accused by some of promoting a brainless and happy Horatio Alger philosophy, defending my own less than spotless reputation while I'm at it, and of encouraging people who are just not our sort, old chap, to apply for membership at the country club. I guess I can live with that. But before we go on, let me repeat my basic premise. If you're a bad writer, no one can help you become a good one, or even a competent one. If you're good and want to be great, forget about it. What follows is everything I know about how to write good fiction. I'll be as brief as possible because your time is valuable and so is mine, and we both understand that the hours we spend talking about writing is time we don't spend actually doing it. I'll be as encouraging as possible because it's my nature and because I love this job. I want you to love it too. But if you don't want to work your ass off, you have no business trying to write well. Settle back into competency and be grateful you have even that much to fall back on. There is a muse, but he's not going to come fluttering down into your writing room and scatter creative fairy dust all over your typewriter or computer station. He lives in the ground, and my version is a guy. He's a basement guy. You have to descend to his level, and once you get down there, you have to furnish an apartment for him to live in. You have to do all the grunt labor, in other words, while the muse sits and smokes cigars and admires his bowling trophies and pretends to ignore you. Do you think this is fair? I think it's fair. He may not be much to look at, that muse guy, and he may not be much of a conversationalist. What I get out of mine is mostly surly grunts unless he's on duty. But he's got the inspiration. It's right that you should do all the work and burn all the midnight oil, because the guy with the cigar and the little wings has got a bag of magic. There's stuff in there that can change your life. Believe me, I know. If you want to be a writer, you must do two things above all others. Read a lot and write a lot. There's no way around these two things that I'm aware of. No shortcut. I'm a slow reader, but I usually get through 70 or 80 books a year, mostly fiction. I don't read in order to study the craft. I read because I like to read. It's what I do at night, kick back in my blue chair. Similarly, I don't read fiction to study the art of fiction, but simply because I like stories. Yet there is a learning process going on. Every book you pick up has its own lesson or lessons, and quite often the bad books have more to teach than the good ones. When I was in the eighth grade, I happened upon a paperback novel by Murray Leinster, a science fiction pulp writer who did most of his work during the 40s and 50s, when magazines like Amazing Stories paid a penny a word. I've read other books by Mr. Leinster, enough to know that the quality of his writing was uneven. This particular tale, which was about mining in the asteroid belt, was one of his less successful efforts. Only, that's too kind. It was terrible, actually, a story populated by paper-thin characters and driven by outlandish plot developments. Worst of all, or so it seemed to me at the time, Leinster had fallen in love with the word zestful. Characters watched the approach of ore-bearing asteroids with zestful smiles. Characters sat down to supper aboard their mining ship with zestful anticipation. Near the end of the book, the hero swept the large-breasted blonde heroine into a zestful embrace. For me, it was the literary equivalent of a smallpox vaccination. I have never, so far as I know, used the word zestful in a novel or a story. God willing, I never will. Asteroid Miners, which wasn't the title, but that's close enough, was an important book in my life as a reader. Almost everyone can remember losing his or her virginity, and most writers can remember the first book he or she put down thinking, I can do better than this. Hell, I am doing better than this. What could be more encouraging to the struggling writer than to realize his or her work is unquestionably better than that of someone who actually got paid for his or her stuff? One learns most clearly what not to do by reading bad prose. One novel like Asteroid Miners or Valley of the Dolls, Flowers in the Attic, and The Bridges of Madison County, to name just a few, is worth a semester at a good writing school, even with the superstar guest lecturers thrown in. Good writing, on the other hand, teaches the learning writer about style, graceful narration, plot development, the creation of believable characters, and truth-telling. A novel like The Grapes of Wrath may fill a new writer with feelings of despair and good old-fashioned jealousy. I'll never be able to write anything that good, not if I live to be 1,000. But such feelings can also serve as a spur, goading the writer to work harder and aim higher. Being swept away by a combination of great story and great writing, of being flattened, in fact, is part of every writer's necessary formation. You cannot hope to sweep someone else away by the force of your writing unless it has been done to you. So, we read to experience the mediocre and the outright rotten. Such experience helps us to recognize those things when they begin to creep into our own work and to steer clear of them. We also read in order to measure ourselves against the good and the great, to get a sense of all that can be done. And we read in order to experience different styles. You may find yourself adopting a style you find particularly exciting, and there's nothing wrong with that. When I read Ray Bradbury as a kid, I wrote like Ray Bradbury, everything green and wondrous and seen through a lens smeared with the grease of nostalgia. When I read James M. Cain, everything I wrote came out clipped and stripped and hard-boiled. When I read Lovecraft, my prose became luxurious and Byzantine. I wrote stories in my teenage years where all these styles merged, creating a kind of hilarious stew. This sort of stylistic blending is a necessary part of developing one's own style, but it doesn't occur in a vacuum. You have to read widely, constantly refining and redefining your own work as you do so. It's hard for me to believe that people who read very little, or not at all in some cases, should presume to write and expect people to like what they have written, but I know it's true. If I had a nickel for every person who ever told me he or she wanted to become a writer but didn't have time to read, I could buy myself a pretty good steak dinner. Can I be blunt on this subject? If you don't have time to read, you don't have the time or the tools to write. Simple as that. Reading is the creative center of a writer's life. I take a book with me everywhere I go and find there are all sorts of opportunities to dip in. The trick is to teach yourself to read in small sips as well as in long swallows. Waiting rooms were made for books, of course, but so are theater lobbies before the show, long and boring checkout lines, and everyone's favorite, the John. You can even read while you're driving, thanks to the audiobook revolution. Of the books I read each year, anywhere from 6 to 12 are on tape. As for all the wonderful radio you will be missing, come on, how many times can you listen to Deep Purple sing Highway Star? Reading at meals is considered rude in polite society, but if you expect to succeed as a writer, rudeness should be the second to least of your concerns. The least of all should be polite society and what it expects. If you intend to write as truthfully as you can, your days as a member of polite society are numbered anyway. Where else can you read? There's always the treadmill or whatever you use down at the local health club to get aerobic. I try to spend an hour doing that every day, and I think I'd go mad without a good novel to keep me company. Most exercise facilities, at home as well as outside it, are now equipped with TVs, but TV, while working out or anywhere else, really is about the last thing an aspiring writer needs. If you feel you must have the news analyst blowhards on CNN while you exercise, or the stock market blowhards on MSNBC, or the sports blowhards on ESPN, it's time for you to question how serious you really are about becoming a writer. You must be prepared to do some serious turning inward toward the life of the imagination, and that means, I am afraid, that Geraldo, Keith Olbermann, and Jay Leno must go. Reading takes time, and the glass tit takes too much of it. Once weaned from the ephemeral craving for TV, most people will find they enjoy the time they spend reading. I'd like to suggest that turning off that endlessly quacking box is apt to improve the quality of your life as well as the quality of your writing. And how much of a sacrifice are we talking about here? How many Frasier and ER reruns does it take to make One American Life complete? How many Richard Simmons infomercials? How many white boy, fat boy, beltway insiders on CNN? Oh, man, don't get me started. Jerry Springer, Dr. Dre, Judge Judy, Jerry Falwell, Donnie and Marie, I rest my case.